This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Here from the Philly-based pop-punk band The Menzingers. They're not overtly political. Overtly.
We definitely have some themes regarding specifically socioeconomics and some bouts of American empire and capitalism, we feel about the integration of those things.
Vocalist and guitarist Tom May talks with John Norton about becoming a band. Coming soon, distracted human drivers will interact with autonomous vehicles. Ryan Denham gets State Farm's best guess on how that will happen. Planning for the 2020 election cycle is underway, and it will be an expensive one to run. Colleen Reynolds talks with McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael. And sometimes it's better not to handle a home gardening problem by yourself. Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy tell us when to call in the pros during GLT's gardening podcast, Grow. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new State Farm study has three big takeaways about distracted driving. The first two are not all that surprising. Cell phones continue to be a distraction for drivers, and if you are on a long, monotonous trip, you're more tempted to take your eyes off the road. But as WGLT's Ryan Denham reports, it's the third key finding that jumped out to State Farm Assistant Vice President for Enterprise Research, Laurel Straub.
We found that some of the new safety technologies that many newer vehicles are becoming equipped with seem to be lulling consumers into a false sense of security. And potentially consumers report that they're looking down at their phones or away from the road more often on vehicles that have things like lane keep assist and sort of automated cruise control.
And it maybe is stating the obvious, but what are your kind of thoughts or hypotheses on the psychology behind that, that being lulled into a false sense of security? Is it as simple as that? Someone thinking, oh, I've got this thing, so I probably don't need to pay as close of attention as I was before?
Yeah, that's our guess. Now, we haven't really done the research to dig into the specifics of the cause, but it does appear that folks who get accustomed to these kind of technologies, you have them in your vehicle, you know that when your vehicle starts to drift a little bit out of lane, the vehicle's going to correct, you know that the vehicle's going to brake or steer when you're coming up in cruise too close to a vehicle, does give people a sense that it might be okay to spend a little bit more time with your eyes off the road, spend a little bit more time focused, unfortunately, often on that cell phone, than focused on the road ahead of you.
And your survey found what I found to be an alarming amount of video chat use by drivers with these advanced driving technologies, actually hopping on a phone, not just texting, not just emailing, not calling, actually doing a video call with somebody. Can you talk about that a little bit? I found that really surprising.
Yeah, we were actually surprised by that as well. We know that a lot of consumers spend time reading, sending text messages, or increasingly something that we've seen drivers do as we've been doing this survey. We know that increasingly folks are looking at their phones. We were, I think, a little bit surprised to see how often folks are using video chat on their cell phones. As a matter of fact, 9% of the consumers that we talked to said that they frequently use video chat on their cell phone while they're driving, and 15% said they sometimes do. Hmm. So it's something we should be concerned about.
Did you notice any meaningful differences between how different age groups, not that too many 16-year-olds or 18-year-olds are going to have a fancy car with lane assist in it, but any meaningful conclusions out of age differences in your subjects?
Yeah, what was really interesting when we looked at the data by age is, not surprisingly, young people are more inclined to report that they will utilize, have a willingness to utilize these cell phones more often, are more willing to take their eyes off the road and take their eyes off the road for a longer period of time. What was interesting, though, is that's not just something we see with young people. As a matter of fact, we know that folks over age 45 are also increasingly willing to look up from the road when they're driving. Generally our younger drivers report distracted behaviors a lot more often. As a matter of fact, 47% of 18 to 29-year-olds reported that they're willing to engage in some sort of distracted behavior. But nearly a quarter of drivers over age 45 reported that they're willing to read or send text messages while they're driving. Something that, again, is keeping your eyes off the road. So it's not just something we see the teenagers behind the wheel with their phones in front of their faces. Increasingly, we're seeing folks my age and many of my peers who are also sending text messages and checking our phones while we're driving as well.
What is the history of this survey? How long has it been going on in this kind of current form? Is there enough movement in the data that you can kind of draw conclusions about how behaviors are changing over time? Is there anything meaningful there that you've seen?
We've been doing the survey now for a number of years, and although this year that some of the questions we asked were a little bit different, I think I'd say the themes that we're seeing have remained consistent. We know that increasingly, as folks are getting more and more comfortable, as our cell phones are becoming a bigger part of our lives, you're walking down the street with your cell phone, you're sitting in a restaurant with your cell phone, they're always in our hands. What we're seeing happen is it's harder and harder for people to break that habit when they're behind the wheel. And increasingly, those phones have become such an important part of our lives that we just can't separate them, even at those times where we should be spending our time and attention focused very clearly on something else. That phone has become such a distraction to us. So we see that little light, we hear that little buzz. People just want to check and see what's going on there.
Why does State Farm do research like this? I mean, I imagine it's meaningful internally. It's also meaningful to some degree from a public relations standpoint to put out the results and have people digest it and look inward. But in your own words, why do something like this?
So I think the main reason we do the distracted driving data is tied to a long, long history that the company's had with safety and safety technologies. State Farm, go in the way, way back machine. We were a big advocate of seatbelts, of airbags, car seats, booster seats. And when we started noticing and seeing consumers reporting that they were increasingly becoming distracted by cell phone technology, by other technologies that they're using while in the vehicle, the fact that was a safety concern was really of paramount importance to the company. So it was something we knew we had to study a little bit more. We had to see, start understanding these trends, understanding what's happening out there on the roadways, and start trying to see what we think we can do to get the message out there and try to prevent those behaviors as best we can.
And your job isn't necessarily to come up with prescriptions to remedy the issue, but if people misunderstand something like this, over relying on lane keep technology, for example, and thinking that it's doing more than it's doing, I don't know, do automakers, technology companies need to do a better job communicating what levels of autonomy are and how these things really work so that you go to a dealership, they sell you on something, you buy into it a little bit too much. I don't know, how do we begin to kind of cross that bridge of better understanding the things that are in our car, in other words?
Yeah, I think it's difficult. Manufacturers are designing things, like I said, that are meant to help us as drivers, meant to help protect us and keep us safer on the roads. I think consumers have some responsibility to, when you buy a car with some of these technologies, to understand what they are and to ask those questions at the dealership. I know dealers are also trying to do their very best, in many cases, to help explain what some of these technologies are. But vehicles have become so technologically advanced that oftentimes, you go through, you buy your car, you want to get out on the road, you want to take that car home. It's hard to sit and spend the time necessary to understand these technologies. Yet it's really, really important as well. So it's important for folks to just understand what their vehicle is capable of, but also understand what it's not capable of. This is probably the best advice.
I want to spend a little time talking about the autonomous driving technology a little bit. Last fall, WGLT, we interviewed one of State Farm's top voices on autonomous vehicles, a guy named Ryan Gammelgaard, a lawyer working on kind of the public policy side of this. In talking to him, he sort of described autonomous vehicles as initially an area of concern for the company State Farm years ago, for obvious reasons, but said now that the company is more optimistic about it being kind of an opportunity. And on the research side of this, I'm kind of curious, what are some of the things that State Farm is interested in when it comes to autonomous driving and the technology that underpins it?
Autonomous vehicles are probably only part of the overall transportation landscape that we're interested in studying. We know that it's probably going to be a number of years before we have truly autonomous vehicles out there. So we're interested in some of the earlier levels of autonomous vehicles, things like the driver-assisted technology, some of the partial automation technologies that are currently available in a lot of vehicles. We know, for instance, many of these technologies can keep consumers safer, keep our customers safer. And that's something that's really important to us and has been important to State Farm for a long time. We're also interested, though, in the transportation environment around the autonomous vehicle. So you think about all of the other transportation changes that we're seeing right now. You've got the autonomous vehicles, but you also have now things like the scooters that are available all over the place. You've got connected cars, connected roadways, all kinds of different technologies that are out and about there that we're very interested in.
This particular survey, getting into driver behavior, smartphones, and safety, it's driver-supplied data. You know, it's a person's own reflections on the things they do when they're behind the wheel and they have a phone with them. So I think it was provided through an online survey earlier this year. So what other data points are there when it comes to safety with these sort of early-level autonomous driving technologies like lane assist? What are the other data points that we should be looking at and considering when it comes to how safe they are?
I think the technologies themselves are pretty safe, and the technologies are designed to assist drivers behind the wheel. Those technologies are not intended to replace drivers behind the wheel. And I think that's one of the things we've got to keep in mind when you have a car that's equipped with some of these technologies. It's very, very easy to become potentially over-reliant on them. They're designed to do very, very specific things. Keep the vehicle in the lane. Slow down the vehicle if it's coming up too quickly on a car. They're not designed to be able to respond to things like a ball rolling in front of the street with a child chasing after it, a deer that jumps out of the side of the road at you. Sometimes these technologies in bad weather conditions, in snow and in fog, it can be a little bit more difficult for some of these technologies, especially camera technologies that rely on cameras. Like Lane Keep Assist, if conditions aren't right, it becomes a little bit more difficult for some of those technologies to operate the way they were intended. So that's why drivers have to stay involved and engaged and focused, because you just don't know when those technologies may not give you everything that would give you in perfect world conditions. So you just got to stay focused.
That's State Farm Assistant Vice President for Enterprise Research, Laurel Straub, speaking with WGLT's Ryan Denham.
Support for WGLT comes from Specs Around Town, proudly investing in downtown Bloomington with a refreshing new look for the boutique at 317 North Center Street. Specs Around Town, Central Illinois' unique optical shop since 1998. Details at specsaroundtown.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, when home gardeners should pack it in and call the pros. It's GLT's gardening podcast, Grow. Turns out in McLean County, you can put a price on the cost for smooth running and secure elections. It's $1.4 million. At least that's the amount of money McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael is asking for in her proposed 2020 budget to pay for upgraded equipment and additional polling places on the Illinois State University campus. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds talks with Michael about details in a budget Michael presented last week to McLean County Administrator Camille Rodriguez. Michael says the message from county leaders is that's too much.
We're all working on our 2020 budgets, all elected officials and other department heads, and we have a deadline, and we've been working on it for weeks and weeks because we have other divisions within the county clerk's office, of course, vital records and recording and tax extension and elections. But elections is the largest portion of our budget. It's a lot of money we're talking about to keep up with new equipment that we're going to need, and we're going to try to revise some of the numbers down because they're doing their job. They're informing us that, you know, that's a lot more money in the election budget. As an example, I think we were at $1.4 million for just elections in 2020. And in the very costly and busy 2016 budget cycle, we were right at $1 million. So we're about $400,000 over what we had asked for in 2016. So we're going to revise them, but with all the recommendations we're getting from the voters and teams we've been working on for the past few months, unfortunately, the costs are going to start soaring for elections.
$400,000 more. People are going to freak out when they hear that kind of number. What is that for?
Well, to begin with, we have to start replacing equipment. So for the new iPads that we are requesting, that's $300,000 right there. So that, and we are fortunate that we don't have to add our touch screens and OpScan screens to this budget, but that's going to have to start coming in 2021 and 2022 because our election vendor GBS has done an outstanding job, and we have been able to use this equipment, which some is 10 years old now, without hardly any problems or complaints at all. But we have to start getting ready for that too. Our laptops that our judges use right now to check in voters, which have been great, will be obsolete next year. So we don't want to buy more laptops in anticipation of this very busy 2020 cycle. That's equipment that's going to be obsolete. So this is the time that we have to build in these new iPads, which are really going to streamline the election process into the budget. We've had experienced judges come in and test them. The IT department has given the approval on them and will recommend them, and that they meet all the cybersecurity standards and such. So, yeah, that's a big portion as we start adding new election equipment to our budget. And this is something that's going around the state and the country with the new equipment demands.
How many iPads are we talking about?
With the software and everything, they're $1,000 a piece, roughly. So if we need, you know, 100 or... You know, we're going to need a lot more if we get our other requests in anticipation of the huge turnout. So it's, you know, it's kind of a guesstimate, a guessing game as to, I wish everyone could be psychic and tell us what the turnout's going to be in 2020, remembering that it was 75% turnout in 2016, but we got the funding we needed at that time. So, yeah, it's just each year, it's how much you're going to need of this, what's the turnout. I think everybody knows what people are talking about for the 2020 election cycle. They are talking about an unprecedented turnout. So are we going to see an 80% turnout, a 90% turnout, or a 75% turnout? It's anybody's guess, but we want to be ready.
So are you planning for the maximum? Because then you're not going to be disappointing people at the polls?
Well, we have to keep our taxpayers in mind. I think everybody knows how busy elections can be in a presidential. So we'll just have to guesstimate. I'm going to stick between a 75 and 80% turnout. But the largest expense is adding more election judges, adding more equipment in anticipation. We've been meeting with an ISU election team and for months now. And it's just going remarkably well, and sure want to thank President Deeds for meeting with me, and we put this together. Getting all sorts of recommendations for what they think. They know the campus better than our office does. And they are suggesting 4 election day sites. And I think that's a great idea, but with that comes a great deal of cost. So that was built into that budget, too. So we may have to pare that down when push comes to shove, so to speak, and we take this finally to finance and the county board, and they say, we can't vote for this. It's just we're not going to have the money. And we'll have to try to stick to our recommendations. And if we can cut some things, we will. And then let's say we have to cut a lot of the ISU recommendations. Then, and the ISU team knows this too, the key is going to be then getting the word out for not only students, but for everyone, to please, if you can, register to vote before Election Day. With that new same-day voter registration law passed in 2016, great in concept for those that really need it and just moved here. An example in Hayworth on Election Day, a military couple had just relocated there, and they were so thrilled that they could have their ID and vote on Election Day. That's what it was meant for. But the long lines are unfortunately caused by those who didn't register to vote. The long lines form. You have to have your two forms of ID, and it takes about 20 minutes to register a same-day registration versus 5 minutes for someone already registered. So if we don't get all the funding that we would like to have, getting that word out, and ISU is going to help tremendously, and all the other media are going to help that too, register to vote, folks, if you can. And I think that will help alleviate long lines here at ISU, plus the fact that we have the ballroom back, and that's just such a huge asset. I think we'll be okay, but the key is getting registered to vote if you can.
And, of course, there are some early voting options. Is there an early voting option that you're planning for on the ISU campus?
We always have the early voting at the Bone Center. So I believe that's mandated, actually. So we'll always have that one. And we have early voting at the Government Center downtown Bloomington. So we'll always have those. But, and of course, there's vote by mail. But here's the thing with early voting, Colleen. In a primary, believe it or not, a lot of people don't want to early vote unless they're, you know, think they're going to be sick or going on vacation because they haven't made their minds up in a primary. And you can see all the candidates, let's say, take the Democrats, for example, that might be in the primary for president, and more might be added for the Republicans. You really don't make your mind up until the last minute. So that doesn't make a big, big impact. But we're certainly going to encourage that, and other groups like the League of Women Voters are going to help us get the word out. If you can, or you think you are going to be out or don't want to risk a long line and you've made up your mind, take advantage of early voting.
We're talking with McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael, who oversees elections for the town of Normal and rural McLean County. There is a separate, we want to remind people, a separate City of Bloomington Election Commission, and she cannot speak to those operations, but really just what's going to be happening in Normal and in the rural areas of McLean County. Are you getting any sense of the level of support that you might get for what you are requesting? Have you talked to other, for example, county board members or some of the newer county board members and kind of floated the trial balloon of, I'm going to need a lot more money?
I haven't had specific meetings with county board members. I might run into one or two and say, get ready for our budget because it's going to be higher. So I will reach out even further to see what's appropriate on my part. But I've always offered to answer specific questions before we actually sit down and say, here's the budget, yes or no, to explain in great detail. We're going to itemize every single line item. You know, here's what every, you know, even to the extension cords, here's how much these things cost, so they know that we're not inflating in any way. So, and that's why we go through this process. And we look for the feedback to say, you know, we don't want to have to raise taxes. We don't want to have to cut jobs. But, you know, maybe to meet this budget, Kathy, which do you want? And that's where you start pondering. I am not a believer in raising taxes. I believe in cuts. So if we can make them, we will. But we have a job to do, and we have to run an effective election.
Well, I know that some people will ask this question, so I'm going to anticipate it and ask you to respond. For these iPads, isn't there a way for you to maybe phase that in and put the iPads in polling places that are typically pretty busy, and then maybe the following year replace the laptops and maybe some of the lesser busy polling places?
That's a great question. It was one of the first ones we've asked. And the answer is no. You can't combine the two. You can't incorporate the two. And that gets into technology and IT and all those things. But unfortunately, because of their two different systems, reporting systems, and everything else, unfortunately, you can't phase them in.
And again, remind us, with the iPads, why do they streamline the check-in? What's the difference between an iPad and the laptops that you've been using?
Yeah, it's just an amazing difference. You know, every year technology just improves so much. And we had some veteran election judges come in and test them out before we proceeded. And they were just thrilled. They gave the thumbs up and going, Kathy, please get these. This will help the whole streamlining of the check-in process. And laptops, you have to go to two or three different screens as you're checking in one person. And with the iPads, open it up, type in this, boom, you're ready to go. So you're going to see the check-in times, I think, greatly reduced.
So let's talk a little bit about cybersecurity, because it's a big concern right now. You know, we know the Russians hacked election, state of Illinois election database. I mean, that was very disconcerting. We heard from Robert Mueller just this past week. The Russians are at it as we speak. So what are you doing, and how are you working with other officials on the cybersecurity issue?
Well, I'll say in 2016, when that Russian hacking came to be in Illinois, unfortunately, about 76,000 voters' personal data was compromised. I don't believe it affected any here in McLean County, and we never had any official reports on that, so that was good. But I'll give Illinois State Board of Elections credit. They jumped on this thing immediately, and they formed their cyber navigation program. And McLean County was one of the first counties in the state to join this. And in fact, they asked us to host the first cybersecurity conference, which we held last year. And then every week, we have a cybersecurity expert from Terrorism and Intelligence Center who sends us on the election team emails. And some are classified, some are not classified, and we go through this. It gives us alerts, what's happened, who's been trying what, and again, we can't share a lot of them, but that's a good thing. They are on it. We're on it. We attend cybersecurity training. We have become experts, and as I told the election team, hey, good news, you're going to be cybersecurity experts. There's no money in it for you, but you're going to get a lot more knowledge. And they didn't even flinch. They were very excited to learn that, too. So McLean County, I think we've helped lead the charge in cybersecurity, along with our IT department, who has a great reputation throughout the state. We meet with them monthly, and if we need to meet with them more, we do. In fact, they just recommended that we get new software, cybersecurity software upgrade. Thankfully, that was paid for by a grant. So they're on it. We feel that we're really on it. But as you and I talked about, let's say we do all the things to avoid hacking and everything else we can possibly do. One of the biggest problems is social media, which doesn't have to be local. The Russians can get on, or anybody else, social media and try to wreak havoc, which actually happened. We don't know if it's the Russians or who it was in 2016, and spread rumors that there's a problem at this polling place, or, you know, God forbid they call in and say, this polling place is on fire. And what that does is very damaging, because it discourages the voter. They're trying to discourage the voter and scare them from even going to vote. So what we implemented immediately after 2016, because that happened to us, is a social media monitor program. We have three experienced judges come into our office on election day, and they monitor. We've got a list of social media that we look for, trolls out there and gossip. And then we inform the media each year, here's the phone number to call, here are the people to call, and verify before you run with a story, please. And so I think that we haven't had any problems in the last two elections with that. But who knows? 2020 is a whole new ballgame.
So the federal government, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about securing our elections and the importance of that. And the federal government has allocated some money towards that effort, going to the states for that. Any chance that we could get a piece of that pie to help with the iPad expense?
Well, that's what we're all hoping for. We haven't heard any news on that, but boy, there's sure a lot of people, and the federal government knows the importance of this. So every county I speak with, you know, they're needing, and many have already bought new election equipment, and many need to, as we're going to be needing to do in the next couple of years, and of course with the iPads. So, boy, they got to put their money where their mouth is, I think, because we can't keep these counties like ours, we can't keep going to the taxpayers because we've got enough taxes to deal with, especially here in Illinois. So we're just hoping and praying for some additional funds to help offset these ongoing increases in election costs.
One last question for you, Kathy. We've also heard some initial discussion about federal legislation that would actually require every state to have paper ballots as a backup to their electronic systems. What do you think about that?
Well, another good thing about our Illinois State Board of Elections in Illinois is that we have always been mandated to back up with paper ballots. We have paper ballots at all our polling places. We print more than we need to. It's a great expense to go with paper, but God forbid the machine shut down, voting goes on. And so that's a great thing.
I mean, do you think it would be a good thing to have a federal law that would kind of mandate that for every state?
Well, I think each county should not have that taken away from them to decide. We know our counties better than anybody, but I just think it makes common sense to have a paper backup just in case. But I think we should respect the counties to make their own decisions.
McLean County Clerk Kathy Michael, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
McLean County government's fiscal year begins at the start of the new year with final budget approval by the full county board in December. For many election cycles, there has been one polling place at Illinois State University at the Bone Student Center. ISU has asked for four polling places in 2020. As it stands now, there might be two. Plans are still in development, but the clerk might add Watterson Towers as a polling place.
Why public radio? We turn to WGLT contributors for answers.
Hi, I'm Norris Porter.
There are a lot of answers, but also some common threads. It's fact-based. It's an avenue for lifelong learning, and it's local.
What I'm looking for is unbiased, balanced news. I want to know what's going on.
What's your answer to Why Public Radio, and will you financially support WGLT?
Join me with your pledge now. Go online to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Up in a few, John Norton brings you the pop punk band The Menzingers. Some jobs around the yard beyond the do-it-yourselfer. Get it done right and safely, it's best to call an expert. In this episode of our gardening podcast, Grow, ISU's Patrick Murphy tells WGLT's Mike McCurdy when to bring in the pros.
Not every job in the garden or landscaping is or should be DIY, and sometimes it's best to hire a professional. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your podcast source for practical gardening advice from our expert, Patrick Murphy, from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences, and he's curator of the Fell Arboretum. Patrick is our professional. Thanks for stopping by for another edition of Grow.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Let's talk about when to hire a professional or when you can do it yourself. Really, you could hire someone to do almost everything in your yard or garden, but there are cases to hire out. First, let's talk about hardscape.
One could build a patio with a seat wall and a fire pit. These are really popular right now, and they turn your house into kind of a staycation destination. You could purchase the material directly, and you could rent the power equipment. Only discover doing this for the first time is not as easy as it looks on television. The DIY patio project could take one all summer. If it's a novice that's taking it on for the first time, even with the best of intentions, be careful. And bringing in the pros after you try and get it taken care of alone can even cost you more in the long run.
Because you're fixing problems or mistakes you made rather than just doing the project right to begin with.
That's right.
I have a friend that did a patio under sort of a porch and then a big fire pit area. He has professional construction experience. His brother is a mason. And so they had the equipment, they had the know-how. There was a radius around the fire pits. They had to cut every single brick to mm-hmm. fit the angle in to do the circle. And this was, I think, 2 years ago, and the bench is still not built around the fire pit. Yeah. It's almost done and has been almost done, but this is where if you hired it out, they're not going to leave until it's actually finished.
Yeah.
A tree small enough to cut down with a handsaw or a small electric chainsaw is something I could see taking on, maybe 10 or 12 feet high, maybe 4 or 5 inch diameter trunk. But any more than that, I'm going to call a professional. And when it comes to climbing a tree with a power tool, no way.
Yeah, that's very wise of you, Mike. Tree work is hazardous even from the ground. And the minute you get a handsaw involved, particularly a chainsaw, the hazards just start going up and up. Do-it-yourself large or aerial tree work could bring a tree crashing down on yours or your neighbor's house.
Lots of YouTube videos of those.
Yeah, that's right. And get a professional tree service to approach the job that is hazardous. They're insured to do it. They can even get the insurance made out so that it's directly addressed to your scenario. Most reputable tree and landscape services would start with a service call. The site meeting is scheduled, or access to the property is arranged for the service contractor to assess the site and the project.
And that might be the first time you meet the contractor. You place a strong emphasis on first impressions.
There are many examples of how contractors demonstrate their ability to manage the project and the client's expectations. And the first impression is one of the best ways to kind of assess that. The landscape architect may meet you wearing business casual attire or a suit and tie, whereas a landscape designer or landscape sales agent, tree service representative, they're going to come out in business casual attire. The smell of tobacco or body odor or alcohol are not good, an unacceptable part of a first impression, and will likely lead to the agent not being invited inside to continue to discuss the project. And once you go inside, if you're a salesperson, you have just been given the front row seats to understand who you're working for and what their expectations are.
And to close that deal.
That's right.
So I assume you're suggesting that the people coming to the house, the professionals, freshen up, wear a clean shirt. If they're outside all day and they're kind of in, you know, sort of working and selling their services, they might want to bring an extra shirt with them.
That's great advice. And that advice was given to me by a mentor, Denny Greeter, who I worked for when I was a student here at Illinois State University. Freshen up with a clean shirt. Your hands and face should be clean. Your hands should be shakeable, right? Smaller firms may not have staffing for a uniform sales agent to offer you a bid on the job, but they can still make a great first impression by checking your gig line. And that's a military reference to checking your shoes, your belt, your shirt, your face, your hands, your breath.
Make sure you're put together.
Get your act together.
The client and the professional should reach an agreement on services and costs before agreeing to the work, right?
Absolutely. An estimate with the price of the work and description of the work is the minimum one should accept. Additional information the firm about what to expect, warranty information, aftercare instructions, what are their policies on change orders, more detailed level of managing customers' experiences and success come with those types of things. If you're hiring someone to build a landscape for you, you need to see a rendering, digital imaging, or something that is a clear representation of what you are expecting to get.
What about once the job starts? It's kind of too late at that point, isn't it, to do much?
Well, you don't want to get disappointed, right, and think you've hired the starting lineup only to find there's a bunch of bench warmers hanging out there. Once the job starts, it'll also be evident if the crew is set up to succeed and execute your project. If the level of questions from the crew indicate they were the last to know, you politely want to hold the work up and start by getting hold of the sales agent or the project agent and get them involved.
So if they walk in and go, hey, what are we doing? And which tree are we cutting down? They should already know that.
That's right.
All right. And what about like just the appearance of the work site? Tools laying around or how the guys conduct themselves? Like if they just leave for an extended lunch?
Yeah, that's a red flag. You know, there could be a reason for that. Someone could have an appointment. There could be a biological emergency, which required someone to go to the filling station to use the washroom, because mm-hmm. that's how you should do it. Is there work conducted in a professional manner? Are they parking or driving on your neighbor's property? Do they appear to be organized, or are their tools just scattered all over? Are they making multiple trips back to a vehicle for this and that when it all could have been taken to the job site to begin with?
And I guess if you see some of this stuff, you should contact the sales agent or whoever you think is the supervisor and talk to them about it.
Yeah, and that's something that the sales agent should kind of set forth for you. And if they don't want you to call the sales agent and they want you to feel comfortable addressing the crew, they should introduce you to the crew later.
Is it okay for the company to make the rounds in the neighborhood to drum up more business, saying, hey, we're working down the street on a patio or on a fire pit, and we'd like to, you know, work for you?
It is okay, but we've learned through business and research and things like that, that it's best to do that when you finish the job. Keep your focus on the person that you're working for, and kind of stay away from the neighbor's house until you've really got something to brag about.
What about when the job is finished?
When the job is finished, ask a lot of questions and make sure you know who to contact for follow-up and service or new work or a warranty claim for your scenario.
If a brick falls off the fire pit, you want to be able to know that you can contact them and they'll be out to repair it.
That's right.
What about references, checking references for contractors, and how much emphasis do you place on word of mouth? If somebody says, hey, I got this great lawn mowing crew, I love them, they trim well, they do a great job, they sweep off the driveway. How much emphasis do you place on that kind of stuff?
I think it's really valuable, and I had another mentor, professional mentor, who used this phrase, life is not fair, but business is. Mm. So, yeah, definitely, because, you know, you're going to hear about the best and you're going to hear about the worst, and you're not going to hear about much else in between. References are fantastic, but references nowadays in this internet age, they can be phony, and they can be created by somebody that has a vested interest in the business rather than being a real customer.
So make sure you're really checking it out.
That's right.
If you have questions about DIY or pro jobs or about anything in your garden or landscape, get in touch and we might answer them on an upcoming episode of Grow. I'm Mike McCurdy with Patrick Murphy. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org/grow.
Find this and other WGLT podcasts at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Philadelphia-based pop-punk band The Menzingers has received critical acclaim for their last two albums, much of which fleshes out the angst of moving from 20-somethings into their 30s. The Menzingers play the Castle Theater Friday night. Guitarist and vocalist Tom May tells WGLT's John Norton via Skype, aging has actually become less scary than he and his bandmates might have guessed.
It still maintained its level of excitement and novelty, but there are certain parts of it that now I think you can really start to realize the parts of you that you want to be you. I kind of rolling into your 30s with the history of decisions that you made in all of your 20s and the things that you like about yourself and things that you don't like about yourself, and now you can kind of really get comfortable with choosing those parts. But the one thing is the physical, I don't want to call it a decline, but the hangovers last a lot longer, I would say that.
I remember I had an uncle who told me, wait till you hit your 30, 31, 32. I was like 26 or 7 at the time. And you're not going to be able to eat like that anymore. And I looked at him like, yeah, I will, I'll be fine. And boy,
he
was absolutely right. Yeah,
he was right.
The song is Telling Lies from the album After the Party. A couple years ago is when that came out. It's by the Menzingers. I was telling you off the air, Tom, that I got an advanced listen to the new album. Holy moly. This is almost another step up for you guys. And the last few albums, you've been getting lots of critical praise, right?
Yeah, that's what we've been going for. I'm really, really glad that you said that. It's funny for us to write and record something for so long and sit on it and wait for the world to hear it. So You're probably the first person that I'm not very intimately familiar with that has heard the record that I've talked to about it.
I tried to get your publicist to let me play some of the other songs besides Anna, and she said, no, you can't do that. It does not come out until October 4th. Don't do that.
No. Yeah, yeah. We are going to put a couple other songs out before that. We have a little bit of a strategy for them. We're going to try something a little bit new this time that I'm excited to share.
The album is called Hello Exile. The name of the song is Anna. I want to play a little bit of this song. Is Anna a real person?
You know, we like to keep up the lore as to whether or not it's a person or, you know, you kind of, the listener can take it and make a person that they know. And we also don't want to let anybody who may or may not be a part of our lives in on that whole process. So we're just going to leave a little mystery around it.
There's another song, Tom, on the album that I can't play, but I want to ask you about. It's called America, You're Freaking Me Out. Best I can tell, you guys really haven't addressed politics head-on on previous albums, and you're hinting at it here that something happened in the last couple of years. Did you have some trepidation as far as addressing politics?
Yeah, sure. We have been not necessarily so overtly political in the last couple of albums, but we definitely have some themes regarding specifically socioeconomics and some bouts of American empire and capitalism and the way that we feel about the integration of those things, especially being a musician. You're like, okay, well, we trade money for this thing that's supposed to be inherently, you know, just like a kind of a experiential from a spiritual point of view. And yeah, so reconciling that's been weird, but particularly in the last couple of years, it's pretty safe to say that whether or not anything has actually been massively changed, which I think the soul of the country at least has gotten a lot darker. The way that it's portrayed and the way that we share it with each other on social media has certainly been a lot more divisive and a lot more unexpected and seemingly not to the old formula that we were used to. So it's kind of just like you know, like a timeline shift almost. Is my favorite running joke on the internet is that we slipped into another dimension where there's a you know, a TV star is the president and all kinds of other wild things are happening. But yeah, I think the last couple of years people seem to be very unsettled and very nervous, especially in the music world. Been having problems with our landlord. He said he's taking us both to court. She got her hours slashed and my unemployment's drying up fast. We both got worthless diplomas from worthless universities. Two bachelors and worthless studies, but at least it made our parents happy.
Listening to the music of the Menzingers, this is WGLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Tom May, guitarist and vocalist with the band, is joining us via Skype. You guys formed in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Is that your hometown, Tom?
That's where we grew up, yeah. We formed in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but we moved to Philadelphia about 11 years ago. So the duration of our band has been spent there, but we've always gone back a couple times a year to visit family. And a lot of the way that we were shaped musically and the things that we like to sing and talk about are rooted there. So a lot of our experience can definitely be said to be framed there for sure.
Well, if you don't mind, I want to stick on politics for just a minute then. That's Joe Biden's
sure.
hometown, right? Joe often describes Scranton, Pennsylvania as hard scrabble and the type of area that he or another Democrat would have to probably win over to become president in 2020. What is the mood now? How does that compare to 3 years ago in a place like Scranton, Pennsylvania?
Before, Scranton, Pennsylvania was a hardcore Democrat place. It was a working class place. It was a place that would often get poked fun of in kind of those like national listicles by those like goofy clickbait kind of news organizations because you had a low incidence of adult education. But that was because you were able to go and get a trade job and work it for your entire life and raise your family. You had the job security and the rooted in the original building of the city, which was in anthracite coal. And then in the last half of the 20th century, that all started to go away. And now it's a service and healthcare economy full of the older generation. And I think that those people were kind of riled up by more of the, we'll say, right-leaning news organizations and things like that, and get caught up in it. So I definitely have, in the last at least 5 years, seen a massive change in the area from one of hardcore Democrat. And whether or not it's a combination of that kind of like weird riling up by Donald Trump and the Democratic Party kind of not serving those people's needs there and becoming what that became in the last couple of years.
What is it that the Democratic Party wasn't doing, at least in the minds of these people, to pay attention to these people?
You know, that's a good question, and it's a tough one. I am a musician. My experience of political analyzation just comes from the people that I know and what media and news media that I consume. And I also don't speak for the entire band. But it feels like everyone looked around them and saw their jobs disappear and their kids get addicted to opioids. And the false promises that the people were delivering just kind of didn't happen, especially in Scranton, where you have a lot of the local government constantly going to jail for corruption. They just, mayor just had to resign because the FBI was investigating him. Several Lackawanna County commissioners went to jail in the last 10, 15 years. It's just been kind of a place where the good old boys ran it for so long and people were kind of fed up, I believe. And then they got tricked. The massive, massive puppet show.
Tom May of the Philadelphia-based pop-punk band The Menzingers, speaking with WGLT's John Norton. The Menzingers play the Castle Theater Friday night. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Colleen Reynolds, Mike McCurdy, and Patrick Murphy. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.